Charles rose in a rebellion against him in Jakarta in 98, he looked into the faces of those Indonesian protesters, and he imagined he saw the eyes of the Timorese. He was afraid if he opened fire on his own protesters, his remaining U.S. aid would be cut off. His security man told me later that they specifically feared it would be another Santa Cruz, that they'd pay too heavy a price because the Timorese had already made them pay a price. So Suharto trembled, he hesitated, and he fell because the people in Jakarta were emboldened. They kept coming out into the streets in waves, and they ended that dictatorship. And all this radiated from the actions of these Timorese, who on that morning seemed like they were crushed. You know, I think the Indonesian generals, the poor generals, must have been thinking, my God, what do we have to kill these people that keep coming back and defeating us?
Alan, we have 10 seconds.
You know, a lot of people have been asking about Trump. They're giving their condolences. People here are not underestimating their power. Americans, we shouldn't underestimate ours either. What happened in the U.S. radiated from the collapse of the American middle class. U.S. could have swung radically left with Sanders. It ended up swinging radically right with Trump. But the Democratic establishment has completely discredited itself. The party is ripe for takeover. This isn't over in the U.S. It shouldn't be.
Alan Aaron, we're going to do part two of this conversation after the broadcast. Thanks for joining us. Alan Aaron speaking to us from Dili, East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO Portland, the time is now 5 p.m. And coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Community Advisory Board will meet on Tuesday, November 15th at 5:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor Aves para Principiantes, Birds for Beginners, November 12th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Hillsborough Public Library. The Hillsborough Parks and Recreation and the Hillsborough Library are offering an introduction to bird watching taught in Spanish. The class will be led by Steve Engel from the Jackson Bottom Wetlands Preserve and Charles Brooks from the library. Again, that's Aves para Principiantes, Birds for Beginners, November 12th. From 1 to 3 p.m. at the Hillsborough Public Library, 2850 Northeast Brookwood Parkway in Hillsborough. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a peaceful protest against Donald Trump turned into a small riot in Portland last night. KBOO's Jenna Yokoyama was there.
A U.S. district judge has ordered the city to come up with a plan for compliance with the police settlement agreement by December 2nd.
Portland Resistance starts a GoFundMe site to help small businesses damaged by rioters.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 11th, 2016. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Ray Bodwell. Protesters convened in Pioneer Square for a third night of protests following Tuesday's presidential elections. Riot police used flashbangs and other non-lethal use of force to disperse the protests after a small number of anarchists used violence to disorient private and public property. Although the peaceful protesters attempted to intervene and stop violent actions, the Portland police eventually declared the protest area a riot zone, threatening protesters with arrests and use of force. Kanan Schlesinger spoke with fellow KABU News reporter Jenny Yokoyama about what she saw at last night's protest.
We have here in the studio Jenna Yokoyama, KABU volunteer reporter. You were at the action last night, Jenna. Can you tell us about what it was like and how escalated it got?
Well, I have this little clip here of when it started to get escalated. Definitely the protest last night was pretty much peaceful for the most part. And then at some point, other news outlets were calling them anarchists. They were themselves were calling themselves anarchists, and it brought in the riot police. So before that, there wasn't much riot police or any really police presence. And then eventually the police started to try to get the crowd to disperse because there was a little bit of violence happening. I didn't quite see the amount of rioting that other news outlets were reporting. But here is me actually standing in the crowd as the police start using the flashbangs.
Police are setting off flashbangs. They're making a push. They're making a push. It's time to move. People are coming towards me. They're making a push. Make it a push forward down the street. They're forcing the crowd to move down Yamhill and up Fifth. Making a push. They're pushing people out the street. I can see the police. They push the crowd all the way to the corner. Southwest Fifth. Setting off multiple flashbangs. The protesters have been peaceful from what I've seen. They're moving forward. They're pushing forward.
What seems to be causing the escalation, and in terminology that the law enforcement are using, and in, you know, the actual tactics?
From what I can just sort of see of the public reports of what is the difference between what we saw last night versus the two nights before, that is literally just this addition of these anarchists who have decided to use violence as a way to get their message across. That was the reason the riot police came out last night, was simply because people started to act violently. I talked to the police throughout the evening. They were definitely trying to maintain a peaceful protest, or at least giving space for peaceful protests throughout the evening. As soon as the anarchists stepped in with their violent protest, the police tried to direct peaceful protesters back to Pioneer Square because they were walking through the Pearl District, is where we heard them call it a riot zone. And so you heard them making public announcements, you know, this is a riot zone. Peaceful protesters need to move to this specific location. And they kept trying to move them to specific locations. But at some point during the evening, probably, I want to say around 10:30, the rhetoric from the police started to change. And I asked them, where now is the peaceful location? And they said that location no longer exists. It's just time for everybody to go home, or they risk getting arrested.
All right, Jenna, thank you for speaking with me and going to that action and covering it. If there's any updates, I imagine we'll be airing those on Monday's KABU Evening News.
Thank you.
The group Portland's Resistance announced it has raised over $20,000 so far on GoFundMe to help support the small businesses that were affected by agitators during the demonstration last night. Portland's Resistance is one of the groups that have been leading the rallies and marches over the last few days. The group's Facebook page outlines some of the ideas, stating that, quote, "Our movement, Portland's Resistance, was born as a direct response to the election of a racist, homophobic, misogynistic, egomaniacal, and dangerously reactive president, a Congress hell-bent on limiting women's rights to choose or a Muslim's right to live, and a state that refuses to tax our richest corporations in order to unburden those most taxed among us. It was our aim to channel the shared frustration, fear, and anger that is so alive among so many of us, considering our future prospects, into a united front for peaceful change." They went on to say that the group does not, that was end quote. They went on to say that the group does not advocate for violence or vandalism, and their goal is to make Portland, quote, "a safe place in Donald Trump's America," end quote. They denounced the destruction, but said that it should all be considered in the conditions that leave people feeling that the destruction is the only way that their voice can be heard.
U.S. District Court Judge Michael Simon has given the City of Portland until December 2nd of this year to submit a written explanation of how the city plans to come into compliance with the 2012 settlement agreement between the Department of Justice and the Portland Police Bureau. That agreement followed a federal investigation that found Portland police engaged in excessive force against people who have or are perceived to have a mental illness. The agreement mandates reforms to police training, policies, and oversight. Judge Simon's order stems from an October DOJ analysis that concluded that the city has failed to comply with specific portions of the agreement pertaining to the institution of a Community Oversight Advisory Board, referred to as a COAB. In August, the COAB went on hiatus, saying that their recommendations had fallen on deaf ears and that they received few responses from city officials or the police chief. At that time, several board members resigned out of frustration. Judge Simon also ordered the city to return to his courtroom in January to review the plans. Under Portland's structure, Mayor Charlie Hales also serves as the chief of the Portland Police Bureau.
Portland City Council has rewritten the zoning rules to allow for shelters to accommodate 200 residents, twice the amount as previous rules stipulated. The new rules will also allow shelters to open within 600 feet of one another. Mass shelters are still not allowed in industrial areas, which is part of what led to the downfall of Right to Dream 2's proposed location. According to the last statistics from Multnomah County, 51% of Portland's houseless people are in shelters. The most recent count showed that there are 4,000 people in Portland living without shelter. City officials state that there is currently a 24,000-unit shortfall in affordable homes. Measure 26179, which easily passed on Tuesday, will also help. The measure creates a $258 million bond that will be used to build 1,300 units of affordable public housing through an increase on property tax.
Prolific Canadian singer-songwriter and author Leonard Cohen passed away last night at the age of 82 at his Los Angeles home. Cohen was perhaps most famous as a musician, but he was also an accomplished poet, novelist, and painter. The plaintive ballad Hallelujah is his most famous song, having been covered by over 200 other artists. Cohen has been inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame, the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Cohen was never married and is survived by two adult children and three grandchildren.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for morning showers giving way to a partly cloudy afternoon. Temperatures will be in the low 60s. You can expect similar conditions east of the Cascades in Hood River. On this date in 1918, a ceasefire agreement was signed between Germany and the Allied powers to end World War I. After World War II, the U.S. designated November 11th as Veterans Day to honor the veterans of all U.S. wars.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
Workers' Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says more than anything, the presidential election was an indictment of politics as usual. Trumka says for too long, political elites embraced economic policies that hold down wages, increase inequality, diminish opportunity, and ship American jobs overseas. Trump made many promises to workers on trade, restoring manufacturing and reviving communities. Trumka says the labor movement will work to make promises of better lives for working people real. Labor will work with the new president if he's willing to work with labor. But Trumka says labor can never back down from its values. He says the campaign's racism, misogyny, and anti-immigrant appeals caused damage that must be repaired. The labor movement, Trumka says, is more committed than ever to help working people win a voice on the job and in our democracy. UAW President Dennis Williams says that since Trump disagreed with the Republican Party on trade, that could actually be an area where the new GOP president might actually do something that helps workers.
He wasn't a friend of the Republican Party. He actually set the Republican Party upside down in the philosophy of trade because they believe in free trade without any barriers, right? He don't. His argument about a lot of these things were not in line with the Republican Party. So he is an individual like we have not seen before. So when I see that, I don't see the traditional Republican president. I see somebody who made a lot of commitment to blue-collar workers about fairness and their right to be part of the American dream. And that, to me, means rebuilding the middle class and having greater opportunities. We're going to see what he says compared to what he does.
Voters in Arizona, Colorado, and Maine voted to raise minimum wages for over 2 million workers. The wages will be raised to $12 an hour. Washington voted to raise the state minimum wage there to $13.50, but these wages won't fully phase in until 2020. The Economic Policy Institute says legislative minimum wage increases passed earlier this year in California, New York, Oregon, the District of Columbia, and roughly a dozen cities and counties helped millions more workers. Families USA says Trump's election means it is on a total war footing in a fight to save the Affordable Care Act. 20 million Americans who didn't have it before got health care insurance under the ACA. Families USA says repealing this law will have tragic consequences for tens of millions of people. The group says it will fight hard to try to stop the repeal. Limits on insurance company behaviors like denying coverage or hiking rates for previously existing conditions or removing lifetime limits on coverage would also be wiped out if the ACA is repealed. Workers Independent News provided by Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Donald Trump told the Wall Street Journal today that he will consider keeping an, quote, amended version of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care law. Throughout the campaign, Trump vowed that he would repeal Obamacare, as he termed it, as soon as he was a president. Trump told the Journal that his shift in position came after discussions with Obama at the White House on Thursday. During that meeting, Obama apparently asked Trump to consider saving parts of the Affordable Care Act. Trump said that the law would either be amended or repealed and replaced, and said that he would look at Obama's request out of respect. About 20 million Americans have their health insurance through Obamacare, but Republicans have repeatedly tried to repeal the law. Now that Obama will no longer be in a position to to veto the attempts, the expectation is that they would finally get their wish. Trump has stated that he is in favor of maintaining the prohibition on insurance companies refusing coverage to individuals with pre-existing conditions, and also favors allowing children to remain on their parents' policies until age 26.
There was a lot of talk on the campaign trail about helping veterans. Now that Donald Trump has been elected, veterans advocates say that they're ready for action and not just talk. KBOO's Sam Bowman has this report from the Oregon News Service.
Oregon has 1,500 residents who are active duty members of the military and more than 330,000 veterans. One of the largest advocacy groups for veterans says, now that Donald Trump has been elected to lead the nation, he needs to fulfill his campaign promise to take care of those who serve. Joy Elam with the nonprofit group Disabled American Veterans says one of the most important priorities will be to continue the reforms that have been made in the Department of Veterans Affairs.
They've made a lot of leadership changes there. They've added 1,000 clinical staff. They've started to really adjust the policies, making things more veteran-centric, trying to eliminate the bureaucracy in the VA healthcare system.
The lame duck session of Congress starts next week, and Elam says there are many issues important to veterans at stake, including legislation dealing with the backlog of appeals made to the VA. Elam says her organization will be reaching out to Trump's transition team.
We want to really make sure that they are educated on the needs of America's disabled veterans. We need to make sure that they understand what's important to veterans and the changes that we want to have made.
The DAV has 16 chapters in Oregon and helps veterans access the health care system and disability compensation, as well as with housing, education, and finding employment. For KBOO Evening News, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, I'm Sam Bowman.
Contrary to his campaign pledge to, quote, drain the swamp, end quote, of Washington insiders, President-elect Donald Trump has turned to prominent Washington lobbyists as he begins to fill his cabinet. Jeffrey Eisenach, a consultant who had formerly worked with Verizon, will help select the top staff positions at the FCC. Michael Katz-Renzero, a lobbyist whose clients have included Devon Energy, has been placed in charge of overseeing, quote, energy independence, end quote. Some news outlets have called foul play upon learning that President-elect Donald Trump's transition team was stacked with Washington insiders, with the Wall Street Journal asserting the conflict of interest, quote, in many cases, the lobbyists are selecting administration officials for departments that will affect the interests of the firms they represent, end quote.
Despite Donald J. Trump's victory in the race to capture 270 electoral votes and clinch the U.S. presidency, most Americans did not vote for him. In fact, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but many eligible voters cast no vote at all. FSRN's Nell Abram spoke with Denise Lieberman, senior attorney at Advanced Project and coordinator of the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition, to talk about that state's efforts to roll back voter protections.
Overall, voter turnout was strong at almost 57%. Many people were motivated by the vitriol during the campaign, either in support of it or deeply opposed. Yet more than 100 million voters stayed home, and an unknown number of them were disenfranchised or dissuaded by growing barriers. The number of black voters was down compared to 2008 and 2012. While there are likely multiple factors involved in that decline, one thing is certain. In the past 3 years, many of the protections provided under the Voting Rights Act of 1965 have been whittled away. Denise Lieberman is senior attorney with the Advancement Project and coordinator of the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition. She joins us to talk about state efforts to roll back voter protections. Voters in Missouri further chipped away at voting rights this election when they approved Amendment 6. What does the amendment say, and why update the state's constitution?
Amendment 6 amends our state constitution to weaken the protections it contains for voting so that lawmakers will have permission to implement restrictive voting laws like a photo ID requirement to vote.
Some people say, what's the problem? So you have to show a government ID to vote. Get one. Your response?
Well, many people are unable to obtain a state-issued photo ID. In fact, 220,000 current valid voters in the state of Missouri, voters who have identification, since Missouri already requires all voters to show ID, these are voters who are valid, eligible voters who have been voting with no problems, who have identification, who do not have a state-issued photo ID to cast a ballot. And for those voters, it may be difficult, if not impossible, to obtain one. For people who do not have the underlying documents necessary to get a state ID, like a certified birth certificate, they will be unable to comply. For some people, those documents simply don't exist. And for voters whose underlying documents have discrepancies or errors, that can be an exercise in futility.
And who are these voters?
Senior citizens whose IDs may be expired would no longer be able to use those IDs. We know students who may not have driver's licenses but have valid student identifications would be affected. People with disabilities and other people who live in big cities who don't drive. And we know that voters of color are far more likely to be affected than other voters. In fact, in Missouri, African Americans are twice as likely to lack a state-issued photo ID than other voters. And we know that working families are more likely to be affected. People who don't have flexibility in their job schedules to get to the numerous offices required to get these forms of ID. Most DMV offices are not open evenings and weekends. So that means people have to take time off work and lose a day's pay. People who don't have access to transportation are going to have to find a means of transportation to get to these multiple offices.
In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed a key component of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 called preclearance. The landmark law was designed to remove systemic roadblocks for black voters and required nine specific states to get federal approval before enacting any changes to election law. While Missouri was not one of the nine states, did that Supreme Court decision embolden efforts in Missouri?
Absolutely. The Supreme Court's gutting of a key provision of the Voting Rights Act several years ago opened the door to new voting, restrictive voting practices in states around the country, even states that weren't subject to preclearance provisions, because it set a tone of acceptability for restrictive voting measures. We saw this year in this presidential election, 14 states with new restrictive voting laws on the books for the first time. It has opened a climate of fear about voting. And so that climate creates a disincentive for people to vote. When people hear that voting is being made harder, they simply stay home.
This year, there were hundreds of fewer polling places, leading to much longer lines. Do you think this broad attack on voting rights affected the black voter turnout in this election?
African-American turnout was down, and this is due to the cumulative effect of new restrictive voting practices, cuts to polling place locations, making it difficult for people to get to polling places, increased lines at polling places that now had to service more voters, and new rules that made it much more difficult for poll workers to navigate the process, also creating long lines for voters. All of these together sent a message to voters, particularly voters of color, that their voice wasn't wanted.
Finally, this was the first presidential poll since the Voting Rights Act was gutted. What's your takeaway?
Well, we've seen this before. Every time communities have risen up to demand a voice, particularly communities of color, throughout our nation's history, we have seen this kind of backlash in trying to silence people who are stepping up, and we're going to fight that. And what it means is that people are going to have to come together more intentionally than ever and more determined than ever to protect our right to vote, because that is the vehicle that gives us our voice in this society.
That's Denise Lieberman, senior attorney at the Advancement Project and coordinator of the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
Claiming that he is very busy right now, Donald Trump's lawyers have asked for a delay in the civil fraud trial related to Trump University. The trial is scheduled to begin November 28th. His attorneys pointed out that Trump is busy with the transition at this time and asked that the trial be postponed until February or March, making the case that he'll have more free time and once he's on the job. Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Stacy Holtman, Sarah Myers, Sam Bowman, and Chris Andre. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Ray Bodwell. Coming up next is Counterspin, but first, here's a few minutes of Rita Coolidge's singing Leonard Cohen's classic Bird on a Wire.
Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my own way to be free. Like a worm on a hook, like a knife